the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. We're going to look today at the cultural wars and conservatism. There's been a lot of debate about cultural wars again and what is the best tactic to take to the fight to the left and just have influence in the political arena. We'll look at Clarence Thomas and some of his recent remarks and writings on eugenics and abortion that came out of the abortion bill that was upheld by the Supreme Court and the state of Indiana. Passed a law. I think Mike Pence, when he was governor, signed the bill, essentially forcing abortion facilities to give a proper burial to babies that were aborted. And we'll, if we have time, we'll get into the Robert Mueller goings on a little bit in the North Carolina budget. So, Brooke, how's it going? It's hot out.
What Happy do you think? Day. Yeah. It feels so good, though. It feels like
you like
summer.
That humidity.
Okay, not the humidity per se, but just that heat. It doesn't feel as humid today, to be honest with you. But like, I've done a couple of laps around the building because it just feels so good outside.
Yeah. I like heat. It's kind of therapeutic.
Yeah, I feel like I'm in a sauna.
Yeah, and so I don't really mind heat as much as the cold. Having lived in very cold places and having lived in hot places, although I will say Jackson, Mississippi, four years ago, I guess it was, almost 5 years ago, spent a year down there. And it was just too hot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there does come a point where it feels more like Hades than
tropical. It was like the hot. Mississippi's very hot. And it was like, I think, the hottest, at least on record, of a summer they ever measured it. And having lived in Mississippi a long time, if you lived on the coast where I live most of the time, it's a little cooler because at least you get that Gulf breeze. So,
yes. So, anyways, it's summer in North Carolina. What are you going to do?
Just be hot for a lot of the time, but I'll enjoy it. You know, we're going to go to the beach here, I think next week. And then we're going to do some trips to see my parents, in Northern Michigan, my wife's parents in Alabama. So we'll have a lot of fun. I know you'll have a lot of fun this summer too. You got cool things planned.
So let's talk about this. Well, you brought up this topic. I think it's kind of interesting. Russian slapping tournaments. What are these?
So I don't know exactly where it was hosted in Russia, but the winner was from Siberia. His name is Vasily Kamansky, and he was a Siberian farmer, and he was a weightlifter, and he won the whole thing. He basically won $500, so it's not a huge amount of money, but
the
equivalent of $5,000. They just go off and face each other and slap the heck out of each other, and the judge declares the winner, but this guy, Vasily, the rule is it has to be open-handed slap, so you can't punch somebody. Okay. So you face them kind of at a table, and you just slap the person as hard as you can across the face.
Well,
and he had two.
Should we do that for
He basically Civitalk? Had two knockouts. I see a lot of that on Twitter. I don't know if we should do that for Civitas. What would you? And you said you made a comment that women do this too. Or you've seen maybe?
Okay, so yes, in New York, there's this radio station, and I thought they called it like Brooklyn Smackfest or something like that. And so I looked up a YouTube video, and the different boroughs in New York, they divide up and they like have these little Smackfest standoffs. So they're facing each other, and then they're taking turns just slapping each other, and the last person standing is the winner. And I think they win like concert tickets or something.
Yeah.
So, like, would you ever do something like this?
The prize would have to be more than $500.
What would the prize have to be?
Since I'm on air and I can't just give the, maybe like a luxurious swimming pool or a lazy river in my backyard or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. that's interesting. Well, I think that I've got lower standards.
Okay, lower standards. Brooke's not afraid to get aggressive and mix it up and hit.
I would get slapped, and I would slap others for the low, low cost of, let's say, I don't know, $1,000 shopping spree at the mall.
Okay.
Do
you feel like it'd be a little bit dehumanizing just to get slapped across the face so many times? I guess maybe after 4 or 5 times, it would just be normal.
Your face is probably numb by that point in time. Yeah. Would it be dehumanizing? Maybe.
But I don't think any bones were broken because of the open-handed slap. But I could be
right.
Yeah, I don't think you're gonna break a cheekbone or anything. But it certainly hurts and stings.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It reminded me a little bit of. did you ever see the movie Over the Top with Sylvester Stallone?
No,
meet
I did
me
not.
Halfway above.
Oh, Ray's
singing I think
now.
There was a Kenny Loggins
singing now
soundtrack, but it was about an arm wrestling tournament from the 80s.
Okay.
And he was in the arm wrestling tournament, and his son, I guess, got involved too. But I just, for some reason, a tournament like that reminded me of the movie from the 80s, Over the Top. But mm-hmm. it's a really bad movie and has a lot of montages. But
okay, yeah. Yeah. Haven't seen it. And clearly, it's not one that made it into the annals of cinematography.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about these culture wars. And I see a comment here on Facebook that says, stop using the terms like war. And I think that. I can understand some people don't want us to devalue that word war, but I would say that war can be broadly understood.
Yeah, war is a broad definition.
There's a lot of things that can encompass war, but obviously that isn't minimizing the physical warfare that occurs.
I mean, I'm at war with red ants in the back of my yard.
Right.
You know? So I think you can use that word broadly.
Precisely. I think we're all at war with red ants here in this part of North Carolina right now. But there has been something that has been trending a lot in Twitter lately. So if you're in the Twitterverse and you're in the conservative Twitterverse, you may have seen this. But there are two schools of thought, I guess, is the best way to put this, among conservatives when it comes to the culture war. And first off, there are some that think that we are making significant progress in the culture
wars.
Wow,
what are they drinking?
And there are others that think we're losing on all fronts and that we've got to fight to the death. And so I think that this warrants a conversation for us because there are thinkers, let's say, for example, Sohrab Ahmari of the New York Post. Mm. So he's of the school of thought where this is all out war and we need to basically take the gloves off. And then There's people like David French from National Review, who said we need to see a resurgence of civility and tolerance and pluralism. Mm. So what are some of your thoughts first on whether or not we're actually in a culture war?
Well, I think the cultural war has largely been lost. I mean, I think a lot of conservatives have conceded that maybe even as much as a decade ago, mm-hmm. Probably longer. I mean, you can go back to the 90s and people writing about how we lost the cultural war. So, you know, what I mean by that is, it doesn't mean it can't ever come back in terms of a love of civil society and a love of tolerance and religious pluralism and, you know, that we're protecting religious liberty to a greater degree. And we're also, you know, changing the hearts and minds of people. If you're talking about a war, the whole point is to win a war, right? I mean, you don't mm-hmm. fight a war like kind of like we did in Southeast Asia where we never really won. And so I would say that, you know, it's largely been lost, though. I mean, the example that he makes in one of his pieces is just, you know, the all-out drag queens now at public libraries is becoming a more common occurrence mm-hmm. where kids are being exposed to more sexual content. You certainly see this in the left is even using harnessing the free market in states like Georgia to, you know, call for, and this is nothing new. This has been going on for a number of years, where they're going to boycott an entire state, right? We saw that here with HB2.
Because of the heartbeat bill
in
Georgia.
We saw that in here with HB2, right. Of course. You're not even allowed to declare that bathrooms have, you know, fine gender differences. So, you know, if you just look at it from a projection standpoint, from the 1950s to now, you can see how the cultural has eroded from this being a strong traditional nuclear family, kind of being the center of American life, now to just all-out war now. Really, I'm trying to completely stamp out the nuclear family and what that means in America today. I mean, that's what I think ultimately the left wants, because that's what's standing between it and to the church to some extent, to enacting all-out socialism and all-out sexual libertinism to destroy the family.
So I think you make some really important points when it comes to what's at stake right now and the real battles that are going on when it comes to social policy and just society and how we function even outside of the government. But within the nuclear family, I would say there's definitely and has been an assault on the nuclear family.
Oh, for sure.
In the form of just the ideas that are peddled by many in Hollywood, in the media, and academia. But I would also say that there is a place for us to be able to understand the culture war more broadly. And I think in some ways we are winning. So honestly, I think that I've been a bit more optimistic than you on this.
Mm. Well, what ways are we winning?
Okay. So first off, let's rewind even before 1950.
Okay.
Let's think about slavery, for example. Mm-hmm. We won that culture war. Incrementally, it resulted in a civil war.
Yeah, I mean,
but
so
that was a dehumanization.
Yeah, I agree with you, but we also, I mean, to stop slavery, where, you know, some people argue it would have been phased out in 20 years, we ended up killing, what, 700,000-800,000 Americans at least, I think 600,000 Americans from the North.
Right,
so
yeah.
I don't know if that's a good model for ending a sort of problem.
No, okay, so I'm not using that as a model. I'm saying there have been culture wars. Like, we're talking about culture war, and I don't think we can isolate it exclusively to this time period right now. What I'm saying is, throughout the decades and centuries in America, there have been new rounds of culture wars. Mm. And yeah, unfortunately, the Civil War is that example that really sets apart just, maybe it speaks to what Sohrab's talking about, where he's saying the gloves need to come off.
Right.
We need to duke this out. And I would say that is an extreme, God forbid we ever have to repeat something like that again. And I think he seems to me a little too trigger happy to go down that sort of route.
Right.
Whereas what I'm saying is, over the years, like, the Jim Crow laws began being phased out, right? So we won that culture war. And so I think there's room for optimism. And when it comes to the Me Too moment and movement, some people will roll their eyes, but I think that was also an opportunity for women who hadn't been heard previously to have an opportunity to speak out against the mistreatment that they had received. And so I think that is in some ways a win. Now, has it been abused? Yeah, it has. Mm. But look at all the pro-life legislation that's sweeping through.
Yeah, I think a large part of that is not necessarily because of the culture. It is a cultural phenomenon, but I don't think it's because of this great religious resurgence. I think a lot of it has to do with technology, ultrasounds. There's been certain advances in technology that have raised the specter of life in the womb, and I think making it a little bit more clear to people. So I do think you're right. Certainly on abortion, there's been a lot of progress made, and certainly a lot of areas of the country. And then there's been a loss of progress
right,
in certain other areas of the country.
It's so, two-sided, I would say. And I think that we need to, in a pluralistic society like we live in, it's important to understand that there are first principles and first issues, and then there are some secondary things. And so when it comes to protecting life, I'd say that's just a non-negotiable,
right?
We're not going to sacrifice innocent children or the elderly or the disabled on the altar of political expediency or thinking that this is just economic empowerment. Mm-hmm. They're in our way.
Do we say the same thing about drag queens coming into the schools or coming into public libraries or just events in general? Is that a non-negotiable? You know, if you have children,
don't take your kids there. I'm not saying that it's now it's taxpayer dollars that are funding the library, right? So that's a deeper conversation, another conversation that needs to happen. But the other extreme form of that is, what are you going to do? Outlaw drag queen
yeah,
behaviors.
No, I'm not saying no.
And I think Sohrab would say yes. And so that's where I'm afraid this could go.
Yeah. I don't know if he would say yes. I think he's attacking more of this idea where the left is compelling people to believe a certain thing. And by using the force of the free market through boycotts, through leveraging penalties. I think in a way, as he's saying, and I think that's why Trump can be appealing to him in many respects, at least from, you know, I think in his eyes, he would certainly call him a good, necessary evil in some ways, that, you know, Trump is willing to take on the left in ways, Brooke, that I think the Republican Party has failed a lot of social conservatives for decades upon decades, you know, maybe a less of extent during the Reagan era, but certainly through George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, and when George W. Bush had a Republican Congress, there was really not much progress made or anything, you know. Republicans would campaign as pro-life, or we're going to do this or that. When they got to Washington, nothing happened, right? They just used a lot of lip service to raise money with those messages, and nothing happened. And so, you know, the culture just kept continuing to erode, and the left was much more adept at using politics to compel beliefs on people now, where you have situations like the Little Sisters of the Poor, who were compelled by the Obama administration that you must accept birth control, you know, that there was no more option. So I think, in a way, it's this from Sohrab and other folks that agree with him, is they're just throwing up their hands and saying, what else can we do? We've tried to change the culture. It hasn't worked. Now we're being compelled to do things basically by force or by economic force.
Now what are we being compelled with?
Economic force. I mean, people are losing their jobs because they're sticking up for something, or, you know, the Mozilla CEO, but there's countless examples across the country where people are losing their jobs if they speak out against sort of this new sexual revolution or something's the new left is pushing. If you go out in the public square and speak out against that, or say, oh, you know, I don't want my children involved in this, you get attacked by a mob. You get, mostly a social media mob. I mean, but then, you know, then your job gets threatened because they go to your employer and say, you don't have a right to say that. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's kind of where he sees things, and it's only going to get worse because what the left is doing, Brooke, is politicizing more and more aspects of our life. So you become cornered more and more. And as more things become politicized, then I don't think the happy tolerance of a David French is that we just live in a pluralist society, so we need to be tolerant. Yes, I agree with that in a, you know, perfect world and a union, but the left is compelling people, and they don't want that for themselves. So if they wanted that for themselves, then yes, we could do that. But they don't want that at all. They want to stop everybody from speaking out against the things that they hold dear in this sort of revolution that they want for the country.
So is the response, though, to do the exact same thing or follow the left's tactics, but just on the right? Because that's what I'm hearing some people champion.
It's not the response in an ideal world, of course, but I think that there's people frustrated because they have been let down by whether it be the Republican Party or people on the right for so long. This whole fusionism, conservatism that was supposed to, you know, make this the great happy country that in some ways...
Yeah, which is like a Buckley concept, right?
Yeah. So libertarians, you know, this libertarian market ethic kind of fused with the Burkean conservatives that are more traditionalists worked very well under Reagan and has completely fallen apart to some degree. And so, you know, to me, David French, for all of his positives, because he's a brilliant guy, he did a lot of stuff in North Carolina. People don't realize he took on the whole UNC system with that Mike Adams case and other things, who was the professor at UNCW that was fired to grant religious liberties. He's one of the experts on this country on religious liberty. But I think in some ways he's stuck in this Republican model from like the 1990s or early 2000s.
You don't think he's being pragmatic and he's being a little too idealistic compared to what the left is doing.
I mean, he has the right, I think he has the right prescription if things were not as hostile on the left. Hmm. So he wants to reach out and be accommodating, but the left doesn't want to do that at all.
So how do you negotiate with the terrorist, right?
Yeah, so I think that's the problem. And I think because so much has been politicized that there's, I don't know how we walk this back. But see, I agree with French in theory more, but I get what Sohrab is saying. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I just mispronounced his name.
No, I think you did it right.
I've been familiar with him for a few years, but I don't think I've ever said his name before. Anyways, so that's kind of where we are, and I think both can be right, Brooke. Don't you think that way in some ways?
So when I first saw Sohrab's tweet about I didn't perceive it as an attack against David French. I think he was just saying, look, there is no third way. There's drag queen sort of culture that is really becoming more pervasive in our school system and things like that. And so we need to actually deal with this head on. So that's how I initially perceived it. Then I've read some of his other articles and thought that I think he's being too heavy-handed. I think he is advocating for a more statist model of dealing with cultural issues rather than allowing society to deal with them. And so I am more of a fusionist. I think that this needs to be dealt with at the cultural level. That doesn't mean that there's no place for laws to protect religious liberties. We already have that. We just need to enforce them and not continue to broadly construct what civil rights are, which we discussed that last week in the Equality
Act. What happens when you do the end around on religious liberty and start doing economic boycotts and using the free market to punish certain states?
Free to boycott whatever they want.
I agree with you, but what happens when people's livelihoods are, you know, if we're going to weaponize politics to the extent where we're going to destroy people in Georgia because we disagree with something they did, or we're going to boycott and destroy people in Alabama, and then so we compel them now to come to the table and, you know, yell, uncle, I'm done. Mm-hmm. So we can no longer protect the right to life in our state because
companies are pulling out. So what are you going to force? People to patronize certain states? I mean, what's the alternative? If a company wants to boycott an entire state, then I have the right to boycott that company. And so do millions of other Americans. And I think it's just this, it goes back to rights and how we are able to use our private property at our discretion to match our religious and personal beliefs and worldviews. So I think that that's a market thing that needs to be handled.
I agree with you in theory, but I think what we're seeing broader on the left is that they're just so relentless in this that
they
it's
are.
Not going to stop.
Are,
so I get with I get the sort of frustration and the people that are in the So Rob camp and say, where does this end? Because you can't, you know, like you said, you can't negotiate with a terrorist. So, you know, we'll discuss this in circles, I think, if we keep going on. So we probably should move on. But
it's so exciting. I like this.
Yeah, so I get both sides. And I like David French. And so conservatives, I guess my big takeaway is, what can conservatives do more to work together? I think that's really the, instead of having these, you know, which are good. These discussions are good. So I'm not criticizing So Rob from writing the piece and First Things. And people who aren't familiar with First Things, it's a largely Catholic and religious journal that focuses on culture, and they tend to be hostile towards free markets to some degree, and they've been critical of free markets, that free markets hasn't solved a lot of the problems that it's claimed to solve. So, but they're on the right, and so they have maybe a small point there to some degree. But you know, we're
but I disagree with them on that.
Yeah,
still,
I disagree
with
them largely on that.
Yeah,
but
so,
you know, anyways
let's go on, because we've got, you know,
we can talk about this stuff in the future. I think we've talked about it a little bit to a degree already, but we haven't gotten into it quite this much before. But I'm fascinated just in the sort of the future of conservatism.
Absolutely.
And, you know, just where we're headed, because in my mind, though, the cultural wars are largely lost, and to have a sort of turnaround, you would need some kind of religious revival like you've had with the Great Awakening or Second Great Awakening, because...
Oh, I certainly think that's
I mean, the cultural...
Vital.
Going out and thinking you're winning the cultural wars, and I know there's always examples like abortion, which is the best example. Like you said, it needs to be at the top banner, just preserving the life of people. I don't think that you can point to too many other examples where we've won the cultural wars. I think they're largely lost, especially if you just speak to... I mean, I just remember working at a place that wasn't conservative before I came here, in the sense that, you know, there was conservatives, but there were people on the left too. And I remember, you know, people were so unchurched and so unfamiliar with Christianity. I remember a girl asking me about, is that the group that hates gay people? You know, so there's young people that actually, that's their reference now to Christianity today.
So sad.
They're the people that hate gay people. It doesn't, you know, they don't understand much about theology or doctrine. It's like, that's the group that hates gay people.
Which, that's a societal problem, and that falls on all of us to remedy and address. But let's go on to Justice Clarence Thomas's statement. This is another thing that has to do with the life issue, but we just need to spend some time just talking really quickly about Supreme Court Justice Thomas's statement. So why don't you take it away, Ray?
Yeah, just briefly, because we spent too much time on the last topic, but Clarence Thomas wrote during the decision, I'll get to just a line from him. He talked about this decision where the Supreme Court upheld the right of the law in Indiana that Mike Pence signed, compelling abortion practices to give proper burial to babies that were aborted. So this is one thing that Thomas wrote. Although the court declines to wade into these issues today, he's talking about the broader emphasis about eugenics, because they did not take up the case about civil rights and abortion. We cannot avoid them forever. Having created the constitutional rights to an abortion, basically created what Thomas is saying there, is that the right to abortion was invented by a very liberal court. It's not a constitutional right. This court is duty-bound to address its scope. So what he's saying, he's trying to raise the issue of abortion. Now that the Supreme Court has declared, you know, back in Roe v. Wade, that there is a categorical right to abortion, now the court must address how that right is scoped out or interpreted, given that there is a question now, there's been a question for a long time actually, about eugenic practices, whether you're aborting a child over sex selection or you're having abortions because of issues of race.
They have Down syndrome.
Yeah,
we've seen a lot of that.
So Thomas is trying to raise the scope of this. And here's from C.C. Pecknold, who writes at the Catholic Herald and other places. He's a public scholar. This is what he wrote, his, just quickly, his commentary on Justice Thomas's remarks. In doing so, Thomas sets a new bar for getting the court out of the abortion business. Justice Thomas takes the accepted premise of what the court affirms, that fetal remains deserve to be treated with respect because they're human, and draws the proper conclusion that the legal protections against discrimination should therefore be extended to human life in the womb.
Mm. Wow. Wow. So Justice Thomas, I think that he does a great service to those like us that are pro-lifers and are championing the recognition of the personhood of the unborn. And so as heinous and heartbreaking as the fate is of these aborted children, Thomas is taking this opportunity to school others, including the rest of his colleagues there at the Supreme Court, on the fact that this is a human being, and therefore their burial should be conducted in a way that is worthy of respect of human personhood. And so, although this obviously, this doesn't change abortion laws, but what this does is recognizes the personhood of those child, in hopes that when other discussions come up, Justice Thomas's statements can be employed when considering some of these other pro-life cases that will inevitably be before the Supreme Court in the near future, I would imagine. So I think that was a
hats off to Justice Thomas. I mean, what he's doing is good because he's raising the specter of this issue and putting it out in the public square that what is happening is eugenics. What is happening is racist, because, you know, we live in a country where we've outlawed, at least from a public square persona, in terms of, you know, you have to rent a hotel, or you can't exclude a black person from going into a restaurant through the Civil Rights Act. What he's doing is using some of that language now on abortion, and he's raising the scope of this. And I think, you know, just real briefly and succinctly, that this is an issue. Brooke is right. We're definitely winning the cultural war on this issue. And ultimately, I hope and pray that when we look back on this issue 50 years from now, hopefully less, that people will just be so appalled that this is something that happened. I mean, whole generations have been wiped out, and we've discussed that before.
Yeah, so we don't just want abortion to be illegal, although we do, but we want it to be unthinkable. And I think that that's where we're going to see movement first. And in all polling indicates that people are becoming increasingly pro-life, which is a wonderful thing. And so even though Roe v. Wade is still in place, Planned Parenthood versus Casey is still in place, but yet, even so, we're beginning to see this pro-life wave. And so that's cause for optimism. But that also doesn't mean we should be sitting on our laurels yet. We need to continue to be engaged and speak up for life. So we're almost out of time, but let's talk about the state budget, because this is your tax dollars. This is where your money is going. And so Leah Byers, our budget and tax policy analyst, has actually talked a little bit about this at ncivitas.org. So I am going to pull up her article. But Ray, did you have any initial thoughts on the state budget?
Well, I thought one thing that was interesting to me that just popped out to me on the Senate side was that they lowered some of the teacher raises, because the House had been pushing aggressively for teacher raises, kind of like they've done in previous years. And the Senate decided to raise teachers' pay to a smaller degree. I think it was 3.5%. And they're going to give more raises, use some of that money to give more raises to state employees overall, because the Senate side was arguing that the state employees have not gotten raises anywhere near to the level teachers have received. So they were going to put some of that money, which I thought was a good idea. Yeah. And I'm a little bit more for that than on the House side. So I thought that was good, because these state employees haven't gotten raises outside of teachers as to a high degree as the teachers have. So when I thought that was good, and maybe sending a little bit of political message that if you're going to keep protesting us, then
if you're going to keep pushing to be unionized,
right?
But that's really what it is there's this union force or union like force behind the North Carolina Association for Educators and the National Education Association. So there's these forces that are really trying to propel this conversation for a higher teacher pay, which, again, we've made substantial progress. And I think you said there's been 5 teacher pay raises, consecutive ones.
Yes, at least.
Yeah. And so there's that. There's also been the push for Medicaid expansion by this teachers union. Right. There's been a push for raising the minimum wage, I believe.
Yep.
And so there's all these ultra, and obviously there's a lot of funding for Democratic candidates. And so there's all this partisan stuff going on among them. And so I think you're right. They're, the General Assembly, especially in the Senate, is sending a message here that, look, this is, it's not all about
on the
you.
Senate.
It doesn't revolve around just this one particular issue. These other state employees have often been overlooked because it wasn't as politically appealing to champion their cause and their need for a raise. And so hats off to them. I think that that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. So, yeah. Brooke, do you have a person of the week?
I do. So let's end on a very positive note. And especially since Ray and I had
this
to
is Brooke.
Out,
so if there's any hate mail on this person of the week,
bring it to me.
Bring it to Brooke.
Send it to me.
Because I welcome it. While I totally endorse Brooke's person of the week, I don't know if I would have picked it if it was up to me. That was her turn to pick.
Okay, it was my turn. So
all the hate mail going to Brooke.
So,
I don't think there'll be any
I don't think there'll be any hate mail.
No, I just saw some people complaining on
social media.
Well,
then the complainers are going to complain and they can go cry in their corner somewhere else. But anyways, okay. So the person of the week is Robert F. Smith, and he spoke at Morehouse College, which is a historic black college, and he gave their commencement address.
Is that MLK's, who's been in the news, in his alma mater, Morehouse?
I don't know.
I know his dad was a... I think that's where he went to undergrad.
History Ray would know that.
MLK
that is not
went to college at Morehouse, I'd bet.
Okay.
$50,000.
Are we going to confirm that? But anyways, Robert Smith, who is the wealthiest African-American in the United States, he's a billionaire. He gifted all 400 graduating students of Morehouse College. College student debt. He gifted them all with paying off their student loans so that they're able to start their careers with no student debt whatsoever. And when you think about it, the average student loan debt right now is $37,000 going out of college. Oof. And so what a gift it is. And so Ray, he's mentioned before that, or, you know, he alluded to that this might be controversial because some people say, you know, well, it's not fair to the students that worked really hard through college.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, you know, so what? It's not fair. It's all right.
Yeah,
it's
we were
gift.
Talking about the
it's
parable. We were talking about the is it the lost? No, the older brother in the parable.
Yeah, the prodigal son.
I call it the dancing God parable, but the prodigal son. Yeah. So.
Yeah, so it's okay if some people get presents and you don't, and you know, it's just like that's is that a reason to have equitable Christmas gifts where everybody gets the same thing? No. You know, thank God for this man and his generosity. And I think it shows that a person that has accumulated and amassed a lot of wealth over the years was willing to be that generous because the totals, I think, are in the $40 million price range. And so for him to pay off all of that student loan debt, I just think is laudable. And it is the way that we would want the extremely wealthy to use their gifts and use what they have, their treasure, to bless other people. So I think that's a wonderful
thing. Yeah, I think I totally agree with you, Brooke. I saw a couple of people just on social media acting like the older brother and the prodigal son because they wasn't fair.
People.
They were just cranky. And I think I'd hope that there wasn't a racial aspect to that. I don't think there was, but I think they were just cranky people in general. But I thought it was great to see. It was a great gesture because, you know, student loan, instead of compelling someone to pay off student loans and that he is the right model. I did see an article saying that there would be some tax implications that they had to navigate because you can only give a gift of $10,000 per year. And I think they had found a solution to navigate some of that, but there was that issue. Kind of sows the complexity of our tax code.
Right. Yeah. So that's a whole nother issue, right? To be addressed. But I liked how he took the initiative and it was private philanthropy that accomplished this rather than a plan like Elizabeth Warren's or Bernie Sanders, where it's free college for all. And it's which the government helped create the student loan debt crisis. And so they're not the solution. So I thought that was an inspiring story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Completely
so,
agree.
Thank you guys for joining us this week, and we're all out of time. I hope you enjoyed our lively discussion as much as we enjoyed having it. I will choke Ray out later for disagreeing with me on stuff. But
did I disagree with you?
On the culture war stuff.
I just posed different thoughts. I don't know if I disagreed with you so much. All right.
Okay.
We're done.
You guys have a good week. Bye-bye.